joining. I want to thank the Bayit Shamayim for co-sponsoring. The Bayit, God willing, will host Sunday morning classes again at some point. We'll see when we go back to doing that. And of course, I want to thank the Nussbaum family for dedicating the Nussbaum Family Medical Ethics and Halacha program of this is a session. On behalf of Beit Midrash Zichron Dov, I welcome you. I will note that our next session is not for a while, because of the balance of the way that the medical sessions and the legal sessions go. The lawyers need their sessions by the end of the calendar year. So November and December we'll have sessions for them. The next medical session is planned for Monday evening, January 10th, 7:30 p.m. End-of-life decision-making, practical issues. We talked about end-of-life issues already in a session last year, but talking about some practical issues that arise in making decisions. I'm going to mute people by default, but you're welcome to unmute as always in order to ask questions, make comments. I do prefer that people please ask questions out loud as opposed to writing them in the chat, because that way I don't need to worry about monitoring the chat. If people can keep their video on, it helps me to be able to see people when I'm speaking. I'm not recording video, so you don't have to worry about everybody seeing what you look like on Sunday morning at 9:30. Other than, of course, you know, your close friends who are here in the Zoom with you. What else? I mentioned this before, but I think about 20 people have signed on since then. Thank you to those who registered in advance. It's a very big help. But I still need people who want CME credit to sign in the chat. You can just send me a direct message if you want, just to confirm, that you are here. A couple of disclaimers. Our topic this morning is helping patients and families deal with mental illness. It is a nerve-wracking topic, certainly for me. In the sense that it's a really serious topic, and I want to stress the things that I say this morning are not professional mental health guidance. I expect you know that, but I still think it's important for me to stress that. I did seek advice from mental health professionals on aspects of the program, and I thank those who gave me input, solicited and unsolicited, both of which were very much appreciated. Also, nothing that I say here can be construed as psak, as giving specific halacha guidance for particular cases. It's really important, especially in an area as sensitive as this, that people seek rabbinic advice on each case on a case-by-case basis. I put the link in the chat for the source sheet, and I'm going to read out the agenda. The link that's on the source sheet above that I'll come back to in a moment, but just reading out the agenda. With mental illness diagnoses on the rise, and particularly in the wake of the COVID pandemic, many Jewish families are newly addressing mood disorders as well as anxiety disorders. The normal challenges can be exacerbated by the close-knit nature of Jewish community, as well as by suspicion of modern psychology in some parts of the Jewish world. How can a family doctor or mental health professional aid Jewish patients dealing with depression, OCD, and other challenges? I actually wanted to start with a poll, which I'm going to activate now. It's an anonymous poll, just in order to help orient myself here. The question that I put out there is, are you a mental health professional, a medical professional who does not specialize in mental health, or none of the above? Just want to get a sense of who people are. Again, it's an anonymous poll, and I'll share the results. Just want to get a sense of who's in the room, so to speak. We have 64 participants, I guess, because I don't count. If there's more than one person on your Zoom, I don't know. It's a multiple choice question. I suppose you can answer more than one. There is an option, I think, for choosing more than one. We have 75% participation so far in the poll, which is good. I'll give it another few seconds. Okay, so I'm going to end the poll, and I will share the results so you can see that we have some mental health professionals here specifically, 22%, 47% say medical professional who does not specialize in mental health, and then a good 40% actually, none of the above. So that's an interesting balance of who's here. Thank you very much for those who responded. Because I see some people have joined, I'm going to repost again the link for the source sheet. So before we actually get into the mental health topic and helping patients and families to deal with mental illness, I wanted to just say a few words about Rabbi Dr. Tendler, who of course passed away on Shmini Atzeres, the end of Sukkot. Those of you who read my week already saw my thoughts there, but I wanted to at least mention it here, given his impact on the field of medical halacha as well as medical ethics. I'm not going to go over all of his credentials here. Everything from smicha and a PhD in microbiology from Columbia University to his career as both a biology professor and a Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshiva University, a shul rabbi, head of a research lab, son-in-law of Rav Moshe Feinstein, perhaps the greatest, probably the greatest halachic authority in North America in the second half of the 20th century, member of the President's Council on Bioethics, author of I don't know how many books and articles. I looked back at my files of shiurim and the classes that we've had, looking at his impact on so many different topics, brain death, of course, alternative medicine, cloning, stem cell research, areas outside of medical ethics, tcheles, evolution, the kashrus of sturgeon or lack thereof, what a medical student should do on Shabbos, all sorts of issues and much more. But really, what I find to be fascinating about Rabbi Dr. Tendler is his fearlessness. And I still remember in high school when I had no idea what I was watching at the time, they brought us to First Hall at Yeshiva University to watch Rabbi Tendler, Rav Herschel Schechter, and if I remember correctly, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik debate the issue of brain death. And, Rabbi Tendler spoke his mind, as he always did. I was in his biology class in Yeshiva University, and I remember him weighing in on a range of science and Torah topics. I still have my notebook somewhere with his comments about embryology and evolution. And then, of course, when I became a shul rabbi, I learned how he disagreed with the majority of his colleagues on many very significant halachic issues. And as I put in the email that I sent out about him after he passed away, there was an article about his disagreements with others on brain death. The article was titled, "Moshe Tendler Thinks You're Wrong and He Isn't Afraid to Say So." That was a newspaper article about it. And I applaud the fearlessness, not in the sense of someone who just says, well, I'm right and everybody else is wrong, but it was an educated fearlessness. He devoted the time and the energy to gain the training and the knowledge that would expose him to a very broad range of views and all their evidence. And then he came up with an opinion and he held to it no matter what. And he could hold his own with anyone. And it led to such an impact, really shaping the way that we look at medical ethics and medical halacha. And we could do a lot more in talking about him, but I'm going to get to the topic at hand. I just didn't want it I didn't want us to have a session without some comments on that. So, helping patients and families deal with mental illness. So the first thing I wanted to do, even before we do the vignettes, is to go back to a session we had pre-COVID. This goes back to right before COVID, actually. It was January of 2020. And we had a session on seeking psychological help. And at the time, I brought multiple reasons why observant Jews might be reluctant to seek out psychological help. Does anybody remember any of the reasons why an observant Jew might be reluctant to look for psychological help? Your turn now. Right. So one issue was social pressure. I'm thinking more in terms of, right now, in terms of philosophy. We're going to come back to the shidduchim issue, though. It's a very important one for sure. Philosophically, yes, Janine.
At one time, it was very associated with Freud.
Mm-hmm.
And Freudian ideas are a lot of them are antithetical to Judaism.
Right.
People were afraid.
Right. One concern that people have had is that contemporary psychology might oppose halacha, whether directly or indirectly, or oppose Judaism, directly or indirectly. I put on your sheet a quote from Rabbi Dr. Moses Halevi Spiro, Judaism and Psychology, Halachic Perspectives, in which he talks about this concern that that modern psychology might actually oppose halacha. If you were to take a look at source number three, Rabbi Dr. Spiro talked about it in terms of the fact that modern psychology defines a behavior as requiring adjustment if it is not the norm. But once something is the norm, then there's nothing to adjust or to change, and Judaism will not accept that definition of that which is, of that which is considered illness. So that's one of many potential concerns under the general heading of psychology might disagree with halacha or disagree with Jewish thought. That's one concern that some might have. What else? What might be another concern? So I'll give you another possibility, another reason why some might be uncomfortable. It feels like religious failure. Meaning, if I am an observant Jew, I should be able to find, meaning, I should be able to find my lodestar within Torah. Why do I need to go to somebody else to talk to me about my mental health? If you take a look at source number one on this sheet from Rabbi Moshe Sternbach, he wrote, "The right path is to go to healers of souls, who are the righteous people and giants of Israel, to show them the path and teach them to trust in God, and to explain to them that God's will is always for the good, and a little suffering pushes off much punishment in eternal life." He says religious leaders should already be able to handle this. I also brought you in source number two, Rabbi Spiro suggesting that all good psychology is really part of Torah also, which is an interesting idea. But that's a second concern, is that it feels like failing religiously. We also noted at the time a third concern. I'm just muting people by default because I'm hearing background noise. There's a third concern, which is about the psychologist himself or herself, which is that you hold them up as a model to the patient. Knowingly or unknowingly, there is the issue of transference, which we're going to come back to later. And potentially, they could lead the patient away from Judaism. If you take a look at source number four on the sheet, an article quoting Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau, who is the past Ashkenazi chief rabbi, father of the current chief rabbi. And if you take a look at my translation in source number four, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau, past chief rabbi and today the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, noted that the relationship between rabbis and psychologists resembles the relationship between halacha and medicine. You would think of it as just like any other rabbi and doctor. But he emphasized the difference between the objective physician and the subjective psychologist. The psychologist does not function in a bubble, and part of his belief, his worldview, and his values influence his treatment approach. In other words, I go to a cardiologist. The cardiologist talks about the health of the heart, and what he believes about God shouldn't really come into play. You could argue that also, but nonetheless, I go to a radiologist, I go to a cardiologist, I go to a pulmonologist, all of them. I'm not looking to them for their personal beliefs. I see you, Rose. Hang on. On the other hand, I go to a psychologist, and his worldview may influence his approach and may influence the treatment and may influence the patient. All of these were from January of 2020. And we noted at the time a range of halachic views, some of which actually said, forget it. You can't turn to contemporary psychology. Not allowed. Others who said it has to be an observant therapist. Others who said it will be good to have an observant therapist. However, if that's not available, don't say, well, I'm not getting help. And I just wanted to show you source number 5. Source number 5 comes from Rabbi Asher Weiss in a video that came out this summer. And I really enjoyed the video. I gave you the link on the source sheet. I just put the link for the source sheet in the chat again. I highly recommend watching this. And in somewhere between minutes 16 and 20, you get the following quote. It's really two quotes that I put together on the sheet. He says, I would prefer a non-frum professional to a frum non-professional. Meaning he talks about people within the Jewish community who are not licensed, do not have professional training, but they put themselves out there as a resource. They, you know, we've seen a lot in our lives, we've been involved with a lot, we give people advice, that kind of thing. And he was asked in this Q&A session, what do you think of that? And he said, I would take a non-frum professional over a frum non-professional. And then, at the end of his comments on this issue, he says, go to the psychologist to get treated, go to the rav to get a bracha. I thought that was gold. I thought that was a very good and characteristically sharp way of presenting it. So I think that's a very important point. Comments on this issue before we move into the vignettes. I know Rose, you had your hand up. Yeah.
Yeah. I just want to say that first of all, I think we have to include psychiatrists as well as psychologists, because some people will go to psychiatrists for varying things. I don't know if that will alter people's perception. And another thing I want to just throw out, and I mean, that's not the previous, but I think that there's a stigma, and to this day there's a stigma. We call it mental illness. And I don't think you need to be ill. Ill, by definition, is that you can't. I mean, it's a hard definition, but I think you can have anxiety disorder, you can have mood swings, but illness is what I think prevents people from making that step. And then the third thing I want to say is, what is the matter with going to somebody who's not of the persuasion? Do they feel that it will affect thinking?
So I'll tell you why. In the follow-up email from today, and again, if you didn't register yet, please make sure that you at least sign in the chat so you'll get the follow-up email. I'm going to include a link to our session from January 2020, because there we talked more about what these concerns are, and yeah, it's something that really requires a full unpacking in terms of the concern about someone who's observant or not observant, a believer or not a believer. But in terms of the stigma, 100%, and we're going to be coming back to that a little bit later. In terms of psychologist and psychiatrist, also, very much agreed. Mark.
Could there be a reluctance to consider drugs as a route of therapy?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Could there be a reluctance to consider drugs?
Yes. I think that was also what Rose was getting at. There are those who will be specifically reluctant to choose medication, although I have to say it's really interesting. I've seen articles which contend that particularly in the Haredi community, there is a greater openness to medication than there is to talk therapy. There's a sense that this is somehow real medicine. There are nuances to this. It's a fascinating topic. Okay, let's move into our first vignette. And I'm going to note again for people, I put the link in the chat for the source sheet. But one of the things I want to make sure to mention is if you have a question, I much prefer it out loud, as opposed to putting it in the chat so I don't need to monitor the chat. So vignette number 1. Rebecca, age 17, has been diagnosed with PTSD stemming from sexual abuse by a counselor at a Jewish summer camp. She is in therapy. Currently, Rebecca refuses to observe much of halacha, including the laws of Shabbos. Rebecca's parents are beside themselves for reasons both religious and personal, and they raise their problem with their own therapist. What should the therapist know about Judaism in order to counsel Rebecca's parents? Now, I want to underline here that I'm not looking to the therapist to offer halachic counseling. The therapist can say, go speak to your rabbi about halacha, but I'm not trying to make the therapist play rabbi. It's hard enough to play therapist. So that's number one. However, I do think that there are reasons why the therapist needs to know more about Judaism. There are things that the therapist needs to know in order to be helpful. And I put it under the heading of cultural awareness, and it goes back to what Rose asked before, the question of why you would need to be a believer. I don't know that they need to be a believer, but they do need to be aware. And for several reasons. What would you say? For what reason, without having looked at my sources preferably, why would it be valuable to have a therapist who understands halacha, who understands Jewish belief? Why would that be helpful? Yes, Bob. You're muted.
Well, it might have to do with, I remember I had a patient who was going to a non-observant Jewish therapist, and the therapist had scheduled a family session on one of the Yom Tovim. It wasn't, Yom Kippur or Rosh Hashanah, and the therapist wasn't familiar with the Yonta Sukkos or Shmini Atzeret and so on, and he interpreted this as resistance. He thought this was resistance to treatment, and he couldn't appreciate why they would not attend.
That's fascinating. So, misinterpretation and misunderstandings, which will bias the course of therapy, right? That's essentially what I'm hearing from you. You could definitely see that. I'll give you something related to that. If you take a look on the sheet at source number 7, from a great article on OCD, treating scrupulosity in Orthodox Jews. Those who were at a session I gave a while back, probably 8 or 9 years ago, on OCD will remember this source, where they write, appropriate behavior is environmentally determined. And just as healthy surgeons wash their hands relatively often, it may be the case that people in certain cultures or religious groups are slightly more bothered by intrusive thoughts, meaning there are elements of Judaism which are basic to Judaism, which an outsider might interpret as a sign of illness. And hand washing itself is a good example, the frequency and the very specific structure of hand washing in Judaism. Someone else might look at that and say something's wrong just on the basis of that, let alone our concern for, as noted in this article, intrusive thoughts. So you could have a situation in which behavior is misunderstood simply because it's not the cultural norm. Moish, you're muted.
I'm not sure it's really a question of whether the psychiatrist knows very much at all about Judaism, frankly. Psychiatrist who I've seen for over 5 years knows nothing about Judaism. It's really, I think, a question of is the psychiatrist able to understand how the patient's view of thought and practice of Judaism may or may not be a problem to the patient.
But if they don't even know that this is about Judaism in the first place, then how are they going to be able to navigate that? They have to.
I don't think they have to know or understand Judaism.
But like the case that Bob gave, right? Bob said the patient refuses a particular meeting date, saying that it's a Jewish holiday, and the doctor has no idea of the significance of that holiday and interprets it as resistance. You need certain information. I see hands. I'm going to get to everybody. I'm going to give you more cases. Don't worry about it. I'll give you cases. Okay. Hang in there. Rose, hold on a second. We have another South African here. The Sappers, please.
When I see a patient who's of if I see a Muslim patient, it's my responsibility to talk to understand his culture and get to know his culture very, very well before I make any judgments about whether his behavior is pathological or not.
Yes, it's psychiatry 101 to understand and respect every single culture, not just Judaism.
Mm-hmm. And some of that has to be expressed in knowledge. You know, it's not just enough to have the respect. They actually have to know in order to be able to demonstrate the respect and to interact with it well. Okay, Rose, you were going to say?
No, I would like to say two things. First of all, if you have an appointment, I mean, this is just common sense, and you can't do it because it's a Sunday or Saturday, whatever your religion, you simply say it to the psychiatrist or psychologist. And if he's ignorant, so ignorant, I don't think it's biased. That's number one. Number two, I will say that probably a non-Jew, now I will put, this is the devil's advocate, but I will say that maybe a Jewish psychologist, psychiatrist who is not observant, will maybe be more judgmental on the halakhic things than a someone not of our faith, who just sees the patient as the patient and doesn't have those preconceived ideas.
I'm moving away from judgmentalism. It's much more about just basic knowledge as opposed to opinion.
Okay.
But I see two more hands that I'm going to take and then go on from there. Rabbi Berman, did you have? No?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I just was going to second what I said before, that no matter what the culture of a patient, don't you need to know what their world is like? Let's say that with a girl, she's, you know, dating, issues of relationship, men and women being together,
right,
whether they're Jews or Muslims or whatever the culture may be. How can you treat anyone without understanding their background?
Right. And there I point you to source number 6 on the sheet. From that same video that I quoted in number 5, Rabbi Yosher Weiss addressing the question of whether it's better to go to an observant professional or a non-observant professional, once he's already told us in number 5 that it has to be a professional. But look what he says in number 6. If a person needs to go to a cardiologist or an oncologist, I would not see a very distinct advantage of going to a frum doctor. I think you need to see the best doctor. When we are dealing with psychology and psychiatry as well, I think there would be an advantage to see a frum professional, because it is important that the professional understands the anxieties, the worries of their patient. The better you understand his world, his inner world, probably the more efficient and professional your treatment would be. Exactly what you just said, Rabbi Berman. It affects the way that you provide the treatment. That's, I think, a very important point to consider. Dahlia, and then I'm going to move on. Yeah.
All right. Well, I just wanted to say that in the 1970s and the 1980s, I grew up, I'm born in the 50s, but I did see somebody that was in the 60s, and when I was like 14. And in those days, religion and psychology did not mix. As far as most psychologists were concerned, religion was the enemy of mental health. And people who were religious were being very confined by their Roman Catholicism or Judaism or any, you know, restrictions of religion. I think it was maybe Dr. Sacker or somebody else who was saying that it's your duty to know about your person's, your patient's religion and what effect that has on them. That's very new. That's very 21st century. No one cared about that. It's very woke. I would say it's about the person's culture.
So I would say it's pre-woke, but it's true that I have heard one of the pieces of input that I got from mental health professionals before this session was exactly that point, that it's become much more a part of psychology to see religion as part of the picture and as a potential ally, in fact, in dealing with issues. Dr. Glogauer, I see your hand. I'm just, I said I was going to go further, so I'm going to go a little further first. And then if the comment is still relevant, then let me know. But I just wanted to note a couple of other reasons to find a culturally aware mental health professional. One issue is the way that the mental health professional speaks. The way you talk to somebody can lose their confidence in you. If you take a look at source number 8 from that same paper on OCD, there are notions within Judaism that one should not articulate bad things for fear of them happening, right? Al tiftach pe la'satan. Don't talk about that. Don't say it that way. And that some thoughts are forbidden, right? Thoughts of idolatry is, the classic example. When treating a religious patient with OCD, engaging in a debate about whether thoughts are inconsequential can sidetrack treatment because religious patients may believe that some thoughts are in fact sinful. Instead, it is more productive to address different aspects of OCD thoughts. But you have to understand Judaism in order to recognize that this person may be living as part of a culture, a society, which takes thought as not quite the same as action, but gives it a high level of significance, and the way you talk is going to affect that. Further, it's important for the psychologist to be aware of religion in order to help those who are involved to frame the questions for their rabbi. For example, remember the vignette we're talking about. You have a couple who's talking to their therapist about their child who is not observing Jewish law. In their mind, they need to say something. They need to set down certain rules for the child who's 20 years old and is living in their home. It's really important that if they're going to talk to their rabbi about what to do, the rabbi has to understand the potential consequences of doing that, of what will look to the child like parental rejection. The parents otherwise can go to the rabbi and say, my 20-year-old is at home and is turning on lights on Shabbos and using her phone or whatever it is. And the rabbi, without understanding the greater picture, says, well, you're allowed to say we have certain rules in our house and you have to follow these rules and all that, not knowing that actually that could be, depending on the illness, depending on the relationship, potentially harmful. So the psychologist who is aware of the culture and understands what the parents are going through will be better suited to help them frame the question properly for the rabbi to make sure the rabbi is going to understand the issues, and assuming the patient is willing to actually have a conversation with the rabbi about it. That would be great, assuming the patient is comfortable with that. So all of these are reasons why you want to have a mental health professional who is actually educated about this religious Judaism that the patient holds to and practices. Dr. Glogauer, you were going to say?
Thank you, Rabbi Toshiner. I just wanted to comment that my parents, Aliyah Shalom, were psychologists, and I was raised in their house, and they were trained in the 50s, and I remember them raising me with cultural sensitivity, so I think that it's not a woke idea that mental health professionals, psychologists, and psychiatrists are supposed to be sensitive to other cultures, and I learned it in the 80s in school. So I just think that that's an important thing for us to know, that it's not a new idea. It may not be, it's one that's more important now because we're often getting ideas forced upon us, I think. It's a very important thing to know.
Got it. Thank you. I think there's a difference between cultural sensitivity and religious sensitivity, and I think the religious sensitivity has grown. But I hear the overall point. Eddie.
At the same time, I just want to mention that, and I think you were touching on it when you said that the psychologist has to be able to have the patient tell them how to frame the question to the rabbi. If you're a religious therapist, but your patient is not religious, I think, Rabbi, you have to know when to bring religion into it and when sort of to stay away from the religious aspect. Is that not right?
Right, and that's something we're going to come back to later on. I'm not suggesting in any way, and this goes back to something I had said in the beginning, I'm not suggesting in any way that the therapist import religion into it. Rather, the therapist has to be understanding when the patient's religion is involved. But I don't want the therapist to be initiating in any way. Okay, Sharon, and then we're going to go further because there's an awful lot still to talk about. You're muted.
Just one point. If the therapist doesn't understand keeping Jewish, you know, culture and doesn't understand where this family is coming from, if there's anything abnormal about this girl's behavior.
Right.
You know, teenagers, young people use their phones all the time.
Right.
If Saturday is not a special day to them. So if they don't understand how Jews practice their religion, and they won't even think that there's... They don't think that the girl's abnormal. They may think that the parents are abnormal.
Right. No, that's correct. That goes back to our comments about OCD. So for all of these reasons, we're better off with a therapist who's understanding. In this particular case, and actually I see a lot of people have joined since the last time I said this, so questions and comments should be out loud rather than in the chat. And also, if you want CME credit, please make sure to sign in the chat, even if you registered in advance. Registering in advance helps us with the paperwork, but I still need you to confirm that you're here. So just send me a direct message in the chat and that will do it. Okay. So in this case that we're talking about with Rebecca, who was living at home and not observing what her parents, brought her up to do, the therapist has to be aware that while Rebecca's family may have a hard time with her choices, Jewish law would likely say that they should not challenge Rebecca for her conduct for the following reasons. First of all, in the case that we're dealing with, where she is dealing with trauma from sexual abuse, her liability for anything she's doing in Jewish law is limited. You can't go so far as to say full exemption. This is what's called ones in Jewish law. Thank you for the thumbs up. You can't say that this is called ones. Ones is a category in Jewish law in which a person is physically compelled to do something and therefore they're fully exempt from any liability. So Rav Meir Simcha Cohen of Divinsk in the Or Sameach, I didn't bring it here in the discussion because on the source sheet because it would take us further afield. But he notes ones only applies in a case of physical compulsion. However, we do have a concept of a person being overwhelmed by their psyche. And they're not responsible for the decisions they make in that circumstance. If you take a look at source number 9, the Gemara in Ksubos talks about this. It deals with a case in which, and this is hard to imagine and to port into the 21st century language, but I'm just presenting you the Gemara as it is. If an act begins as rape, a woman was raped, and at some point within the act, it becomes consensual. Again, don't ask me questions about the psychology going on in this, because it's not the point. Even if she says, leave him be, someone wants to stop him, and she says, don't stop him, meaning that if he had not gone to her, she says, I would have hired him. Nonetheless, this is not called consensual. There's no disruption to her relationship with her husband in such a terrible case. Why? Because even if she says that it became willing, it was, as the Gemara's term puts it, Yetzer al-Bisha. It was because some urge clothed her. I'm not getting into the psychology behind this. It's a fascinating question, and I know there are counselors on this session who could speak to it in a far more intelligent and experienced way than I can. My point is not to discuss the ins and outs of the rape case. My point is to say that there is a recognition that in certain circumstances, drives within a person, for psychological reasons, will push them to do things that the Torah prohibits, and they are not held responsible. It's not a total exoneration like ones. Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector has a nice discussion of this, but it certainly mitigates. And that's really important because their rabbi, the patient, the couple's rabbi, should understand that what Rebecca is doing is not her own decision. It's driven by the trauma that she experienced. That's number one. Number two, when it comes to instructing others in religious behavior, Jewish sources emphasize visible love being far more effective than direct rebuke. I brought you an example of that in source number 10. With the classic Talmudic statement, I'm just reading my translations in the interests of time. Always the left should push away and the right should draw near. The idea in Judaism, as in many cultures, is that the right hand is the stronger hand, the left hand is the weaker hand. So if you have to push somebody away for whatever reason, make sure you are bringing them back with the stronger hand. And they give you two examples, which the Talmud discusses, of people who made the mistake of pushing somebody away instead of making the emphasis on drawing near. I also brought you source number 11, just because I saw it the other day in preparing a different class, and I really liked it. It's from Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet, the Rashba. And Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet was a very blunt and very forceful writer. He was the leading halachic authority of the end of the 13th century, beginning of the 14th century in Spain, but really even beyond Spain. He was consulted everywhere. Those who were at my class last Wednesday morning know he left behind more than 3,000 published responsa, way more than anybody else of his day, by like more than 1,000. And he never hesitated to tell you what he thought. And look what he says here in his advice about how to instruct people who are sinning. He says, this is what I replied to the sage Rabbi Yaakov ben HaKashaf, leader of the yeshiva in Toledo, regarding leading the community and rebuking the sinners. Know that a soft tongue breaks bones. Speak softly. Know further that one cannot treat all people the same way. And please remember how David, our master and king, ignored what Yoab and Shimei did, even though they were liable for death. He felt, you know what? Ignore it, you'll be better off. For everything has an appointed time, we're at the top of the next page, and ignoring the sinner may be a mitzvah at times, all according to the needs of the moment. The sage ignores easily at times. Right? It makes sense that you don't have to pick on everything, and sometimes you don't have to pick on anything. To give you a more contemporary version of this, take a look at source number 12 from Vin News out of Bnei Brak in 2018. The headline is, Leading Charedi Rabbi Says Non-Religious Children Deserve Respect. A remarkable video has emerged of Rabbi Gershon Edelstein, one of the two preeminent leaders of the Charedi world, advising families with children who have become non-religious not to reprimand them or kick them out of the house, but instead to show them warmth and kindness. It is forbidden to shout at them. It's like putting a stumbling block before the blind, says the rabbi, meaning that by reprimanding them, such children would be likely to further distance themselves from religion, and said that pressure on them damages and hurts them. Asked whether or not parents should insist that a boy wear a yarmulke or a girl dress modestly, Rabbi Edelstein responded, God forbid, saying that doing so would only distance them. Parents need to accept them without laws or conditions or restrictions, only through the way of kiruv, drawing them close, he says. So, taking it from the Gemara all the way through to 2018, you're seeing what I think is a consistent message. And by the way, recognize, none of the sources I just brought are talking about a case of mental illness. They're talking about, you know, as far as you can see in any of them, just regular people who are not dealing with trauma. Unlike our case where we're talking about someone who was traumatized, so all the more so. The Torah's image of parents in particular is that they don't give up. They don't give up on someone. There's a pasuk in Yeshaya. I was going to bring it on the sheet, but felt that the sheet was getting long enough. Hatishkach isha ulah merachem ben bitna. Right, it's in Yeshaya chapter 49. Does a woman forget her child? Does a woman not have mercy on the one who was born from her womb? We pray for the verse at the end of Malachi, when Hashem will restore the hearts of parents to their children and children to their parents. That's what we look for. Last point within this section is that we believe in giving people a way to come back. That's basic in Judaism. I brought you a comment from Nachmanides from Ramban in source number 13. In a different area, he's talking about laying siege to a city in a time of war. And he says, you know, don't besiege the city on all four sides. Make sure you always leave one side open so that they'll be able to escape. Because if you put them with their back against the wall, then they're going to fight you. And I find that an appropriate analogy for the way that Judaism looks at parenting when the child isn't doing what they're supposed to be doing. They always leave a side open. Don't put them with their back against the wall. And my favorite example of this is Avraham. Specifically Avraham with Yishmael. If you follow the Torah reading that we read yesterday in Shul, you know that Hashem says to Avraham, you're going to have a son, and he's going to follow in your ways and be the one who's going to continue the line. And what does Avraham say back to God? What's his response? Avraham says back to God, Lu Yishmael yechya lefanecha. He says, I just want Yishmael to live before you. I have a son. I would be happy if Yishmael would continue the path. And it's fascinating to see the way this plays out. Because in the beginning of next week's portion, you're going to have visitors come to the house. And Avraham is going to rush around making sure that there's food for them. He's going to ask Sarah to do this. And he turns to a na'ar, to a youth, and asks the youth to help prepare the food. And if you take a look at source number 14, who is the youth? Medrash and Bereishis Rabba, Vayitein El Hanar, he gave it to the young man. That's Yishmael, to energize him in mitzvot. Avraham never gives up on Yishmael. And of course, we know he doesn't want to evict him from the house, even though with the 17-year-old Yishmael is endangering his 3-year-old brother. Avraham does not want to evict him. And I brought you this medrash in Pirkei d'Rabbi Eliezer, which I'm not going to read aloud because it's long, but I brought it for you in source number 15, which actually envisions Avraham going back to Yishmael after he's been evicted from the house, going to his house and looking for him and trying to still to give him messages, trying still to draw him back. And of course, we actually are familiar, or may not be familiar, but I think a lot of people are familiar with the fact that the Gemara says he actually did do tshuva. Yishmael did repent in the end. So it does pay off. Doesn't always pay off. It happens to be that there, the Gemara says that it did. But my point in bringing this is to say that the therapist should be aware that talking to the rabbi can be a good thing and can help lead along these lines, that, you know, as long as the rabbi understands what's going on, that the Rebecca's liability for what she's doing is limited. The emphasis in Jewish sources is much more on visible love than direct rebuke. The Torah's image of parents is that they do not give up on the child. And we believe in giving people a way to come back. Now, having presented all the sweetness and light, now we have to go to the other side. Because the other side is that there are aspects of Torah and Jewish community that unfortunately will encourage Rebecca's family to actually be harsh with her, that, you know, lay down the law and tell her this is what you have to do. What factors do you see within Torah or within the Jewish world that would lead the parents to skip over everything we just said and say we have to set rules for her behavior? What factors? Yeah, Dr. Nussbaum. You're muted. Sorry?
There are other children in the family that could have very bad consequences.
Right. In two ways, right? Consequences in terms of influence on siblings as well as, you know, nieces and nephews and cousins, right? If they see her doing certain things, dressed in a certain way, it's going to influence them. And also, Sharon mentioned before the issue of shiduchim. You know, if people see her walking around the community this way, then what are they going to say about the siblings? And might they be reluctant to in a world in which things are set up, to arrange such a setup? Or what are they going to say if someone asks them about the family? So there are pressures like that from the community. There's social pressure. I would add one more point, and then I'm going to turn to Dr. Habot. Which is that in a close-knit community, there is at times an aura of judgment, intended or unintended. I have neighbors, they see what my kid is doing, they know, I know that it's not the way we raise our kids. There's a sense of people know what's going on in my house, and people are aware, and people are judging whether it's intended or not. Dr. Abel, you were going
to
say.
It's more relevant in the case of a younger child, but you want them to also be able to stay in their religious day school.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're not towing that line, then there's a severe social and educational component.
Right. Excellent point. For them to be allowed to remain in the school, and some schools are more understanding than others. But it's definitely true. You don't want them to be forced out of that environment. That's a good point. Yes, Rose. You're muted.
I just want to ask a question. Do we have to assume that the parents know what happened to her? That's the first question.
That's my case. My case is where they know.
Oh, they do know. Okay. That's what I want to talk. Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry.
So I think these are important points. I think there's also another issue. There are certain behaviors that are sort of basic to Jewish life that are going to lead to pressure on Rebecca just naturally. We have a culture in our community of going to shul on Shabbos. And the fact is that other members of the household are going to be going. Is it unusual for the parents to say to Rebecca Friday night, do you want us to wake you up for shul? A culture of discussing Torah at meals, right? That puts pressure. There's automatic built-in pressure in our world. So, you know, add in now concern from a religious perspective on the parents themselves. They have a sense of responsibility for what she does. We have a mitzvah of chinuch, of educating your children. They think of themselves as her primary religious influence, and they're even afraid for her. Maybe they worry about what's going to be for her religiously in the future. So the therapist should be aware that even if Judaism is saying, don't say anything harsh, don't impose restrictions, nonetheless, there's a lot of pressure on the parents to do exactly that. So I think that the last piece on this vignette may be the most important, which is knowing that the parents may be drawn into rebuking at some point, knowing that the parents may be drawn into instructing at some point, it's really important for the therapist to explain to them how to validate. Right? Validating without accepting what the child is doing, but understanding how to validate. As I understand it, and the mental health professionals feel free to correct me or update me, as I understand it, validating is fundamentally about empathy. Right? It's about presenting yourself as understanding what they feel and what they want, even if you disagree with their decisions. Not that you're accepting their decision as right, not that you're saying, this is what I would choose to do or recommend to do, but the idea of understanding where they're coming from and why they are doing what they are doing. In Jewish, is that a fair explanation of validation? I got a thumbs up there, thank you. So that's actually built into Judaism's mitzvah of tochacha. We have a mitzvah in Judaism of instructing people if they're doing things that are wrong. However, it has to begin with that expression of empathy. I brought you the Gemara in source number 16. It's a classic Gemara in Bava Metzia, which talks about what's called in Hebrew ona'at divarim, or ona'as divarim, which I translate as verbal abuse, using your power against somebody else verbally. And if you take a look at the Talmud there, in source number 16, the Torah says, Parshas Bahar, you shall not abuse each other. This is verbal abuse. How? Give me an example. If he had repented, the person you're talking to did things that were wrong, and then repented, you should not say to him, remember your first deeds, remember what you used to do. If he was descended from people who had converted, you shouldn't say to him, remember your parents' deeds. If he had converted, and he had now come to learn Torah, you don't say to him, the mouth that ate non-kosher will now learn the Torah spoken by the mouth of God. It's not nice. If he is suffering, if he is ill, if he buries his children, one should not say to him, as his friend said to Job, your reverence is your confidence, your hope and the end of your path. He was innocent and is destroyed. And the last piece is the most important one. Job's visitors are criticized for the way they speak to him. They're trying to fulfill the mitzvah of tochacha, of religious instruction. However, they are criticized for doing it in a harsh way without understanding where he is coming from. You have to express yourself in a loving way, in a respectful way, in an empathetic way. There's more in the Gemara there about them. There's a lot more to be said about Eov, about Job. But instead, I want to point you to source number 17. Rabbi Yisrael Belsky, who passed away a couple of years ago, one of the poskim for the OU in its kashrus division, has an interview online, and I gave you the link, where he talks about tochacha, about instructing others. And he gives you three principles for how to carry it out. And I'm brought here his third one. The third principle is, lo sisna esachicha bilavavecha, hocheach tochiach. You should not hate your fellow in your heart, give him rebuke. So he comments on that and says, or give him reproof. He says, in other words, don't hate him while you are reproving him. The first thing to do is to work on yourself, so that you will love the person who you are criticizing. In this way, when you see him do something wrong, you will tend to see him as being justified in doing what he did. First, you have to understand why he would do what he did. Understand it from that person's perspective. You will think that he is really a better person than you are, and he's entitled to think the way he does. Anything he does wrong is only because of specific circumstances. You'll think if the same thing would happen to you, you would probably be doing much worse. That's the way you come to look at yourself. Thank God you never had the test that would have brought you to do this, since you know you would have failed miserably. You have to appreciate the other person and respect the other person to such an extent that you really grasp where they're coming from before you can ever start to tell people, I think it should be X. It's worth seeing the whole article to see his other two points, because they really fit in with this as well. But given this, I think that there's a very strong basis in Judaism for a validating approach as part an empathetic approach. So that if the parents have to speak to their daughter for whatever reason, because of their siblings and cousins, because of shiduchim for their siblings, because of pressure in terms of the school, whatever the motivation is, they still have to know how to do it. And I think that's really, really critical. And again, as I said before, the therapist can't deploy this information about Judaism directly. The therapist's job is not to be the rabbi. But knowing the culture may help the therapist to navigate the conversation. You follow? That's what I'm getting at. Yes, Robbie, please.
So, as a therapist,
yes.
One of the things that's so striking is if this family were coming, everyone's talking about halacha, no one's talking about the fact that this child's life may be ruined by someone possibly also in the community that abused her.
Right.
And I think this is where there's a big conflict, and there's a lot of pushback not to say anything, and they're dealing with something that's easier to deal with, the halacha of Shabbat.
Right. So
rather than after trauma. And I think this is where it seems so clear-cut, particularly for non-from therapists. You know, there's a lot of pushback in the community. Don't make a big deal. Don't do this. Maybe she, whatever.
Right. So I definitely appreciate what you're saying, and thank you for saying it. It's interesting. I gave a session for lawyers on this, I don't know, 7 years ago, 8 years ago, 9 years ago, something like that. It's available on YU Torah, on the obligation to report abuse. And 100%, without any doubt, any way, shape, or form, this has to be pursued. It isn't as though you say, well, I'm going to help her, you know, deal with her trauma and leave the abuser. It doesn't work that way. So thank you for stressing it, and yes, it must be said. Okay, this was all vignette number one, and it's already 10:30. So I'm going to move on to vignette number two. I knew I wasn't getting to vignette number four, but I did hope to get to number three. So vignette number two, Sam, a geriatric psychologist, sees patients in an assisted living facility. One of the patients, Chaim, who is dealing with depression, learns Daf Yomi on a regular basis. Daf Yomi is daily Talmud study. Sam believes that bringing Torah-based material related to depression might reach Chaim in ways that secular counseling could not. Is relating Torah-based messages to Chaim as part of therapy a good idea? What sparked this vignette is that when I prepared the session I gave in early 2020 on seeking psychological help, I heard from some psychologists who are on this call that it's really important to talk about including Torah, because Torah has so much to say about mental health, which it definitely does. And I heard from others in leading up to that session saying it's really important that Torah be kept separate from therapy, that it not be incorporated in the therapeutic process. So I heard opposite opinions. It seems very clear to me that rabbis can be a big help in therapy, and I hope that that's, you know, understood in its own right. I brought you on the sheet in source number 18, a source that I've brought before, Rabbi Shlomo Wolbe, talking about the importance of rabbis getting training in mental health issues so that they will be able to respond properly to students of theirs. He's talking about a rabbi in a yeshiva setting, so that they can respond properly to students who are having trouble, knowing when to refer them, knowing when problems are religious problems and when problems are psychological problems. And if in the interest of time, I'm not going to read it aloud, but I really recommend reading what Rabbi Wolbe says there, because it's really, really important. But that's not the same thing as bringing Torah into therapy. That's talking about the rabbi having training to know when things are in the rabbi's department and when they're not. Yes, Dr. Habov, you've been waiting very patiently.
I guess related to something a previous guest said, if it's clear that there's an interest and this person is clearly interested in Judaism and so on and so forth, I think it's a great opportunity to draw ideas from Judaism that will help the person reframe the issue and so on and so forth. Having said that, I did try that one time from a patient who clearly put me in my place and said that I was her doctor and I was not her rabbi. Mm. And then the other point was that we all have to be very careful not to know how to give psak halakha and think that we know more than we do when it comes to true halakha.
Mm-hmm. Very, very true. On both points, the value that it can have, I think, is really significant. I mean, if you have somebody who's dealing with anxiety, theoretically, and I'm not saying the therapist should say this, please let me make that clear, but Judaism has a lot about accepting uncertainty. You know, in halacha, we talk about this all the time. If you have doubt on a biblical matter, what do you do? If you have doubt on a rabbinic matter, what do you do? There's a lot about accepting and living with uncertainty. Depression, worlds of material, some of which I received from mental health professionals in the run-up to this session, talking about issues of gratitude, talking about validation. I actually brought you a fascinating piece. Take a look at source number 19. I like this too much to skip it. Rabbi Dr. Shalom Carmi, in an article on religious optimism and the meaning of life, talks about yibum. Yibum is often translated with the non-translation as leveret marriage, because that totally explains what yibum is. Yibum is a law regarding a case in which, God forbid, a man passes away without having any children, and now his wife has the option of marrying his brother as the mitzvah of yibum, and then producing children. And if you look at source number 19, Rabbi Carmi writes, paradoxically, Rabbi Cook suggests that yibum is a better model for Jewish reflection on the family, precisely because the extraordinary and tragic illuminates the normal. I should explain what leads him to this point. He's dealing with the fact that when you learn the Talmud, the section that deals with issues of marriage begins with Yevamot, with the laws of this leveret marriage. It doesn't begin with laws of marriage. It begins with laws of leveret marriage. If you're starting talking about marriage, you should have started with marriage, right? Start with Kiddushin. Start with Ketuvot. But it doesn't. It starts with Yevamot. So that's where this piece comes in. He says, Yibum is a better model for Jewish reflection on the family, precisely because the extraordinary and tragic illuminates the normal. The life of Torah is not ordinary life, but eternal, both in its spiritual and material dimensions. For that reason, Torah life is manifest not only under ideal circumstances, but also in situations of destruction, even when, quote, the natural structure has broken down and the family is destroyed. In other words, people need to understand going in that things in this world do break, that this happens, and that our system is meant to recognize that and deal with it, recognize that there is brokenness in our world. That can be very meaningful for people who are dealing with depression. It can be very meaningful for people who are dealing with bereavement. It can be very meaningful if people are dealing with marital issues. On a different plane, if you take a look at source number 20, Rambam Maimonides, in his Shmona Prakim, which is his introduction to Pirkei Avot, talks about the value of music therapy. You can find plenty of sources that are helpful. But now I come back to our question. Is it a good idea for a therapist to bring in these sources? Right? Is that really a good idea? So tell me what the benefits are of bringing it in. We've already heard a little bit from Dr. Abo. What are the benefits of bringing this into therapy? Yeah, Eddie.
I think you have to know your patient, and you have to have some idea of how willing or accepting your patient will be of hearing this before you start. In your case, you might think that maybe the patient might be receptive because he already studies stephanomy every day, so he has that particular slant. But you better be sure that your patient is sort of into that, you know, into hearing that before you bring it in.
Right, so you're already at the stage of you better be sure. But I want to know, what are the benefits that come from it? I mean, I've already said that there are sources that can relate to what the patient is going through and even lead to guidance. That's one thing. Yes, Dr. Abo.
Again, the COVID pandemic issues aside, perhaps he's actually learning in person with somebody, and the social structure of the Daf Yomi provides a good framework for him to be with people, with friends, with others when he learns. That would be a good structure for part of the day. But certainly it shouldn't be, he should still be addressing his depression, because if he's already doing Daf Yomi and he's still depressed, obviously he needs more than that.
Yeah. I wasn't even thinking about the piece that you're adding here, which is recommending social study as a way for them to be involved with others in a positive and productive environment, or what I hope is positive and productive. I would offer the following benefits in addition. I think that, Dr. Saffer.
It also depends on how you present it. If you present it in a way like, for example, I would say to a patient, it's very interesting. Our tradition has this to say about that, which mm-hmm. is a kind of benign suggestion mm-hmm. rather than a prescription.
Right. I hear that. So making sure that it's clear that you're not playing rabbi, you're just
yeah.
introducing something for thought.
Right.
Definitely hear that. I think that some of the benefits include here, was that from Alana or from Orly? Can't tell which one it is.
So I was just thinking, in terms of like a lot of therapy, self-actualization is like a huge component of therapy, and have been making somebody feel like better. And so if the person like is a religious person, and that part of their self-actualization is like growing as a religious person, then providing Torah sources that also like elucidate on their problems, and like helping them step towards like incorporating religion into every part of their life, which might be part of their self-actualization, is incredibly helpful.
So self-actualization, a good potential benefit from it. Thank you for pointing that out. I definitely hear that. I think it can be comforting for the patient also, assuming it's authentic. It can be very comforting for the patient to hear that. It's what they're used to, assuming it is what they're used to. I think it also can aid communication via common language. Again, if this is a patient for whom this kind of thing is meaningful. Not to mention, I'm just going to go through my list here. It has religious value as a mitzvah. there is a mitzvah of learning Torah with people. Let's not forget that. Also, the issue of transference, right? In transference, to in a nutshell, as I understand it, the patient may start to see the counselor as some other authority figure, make an association with some other authority figure, and transfer the feelings they have for that other figure to the counselor. So they may start to see the counselor as like their parent or as like their rabbi. Now, that can actually be a healthy thing. Meaning, if the patient has respect for Torah, and now the therapist is presenting as a person who is versed in Torah, that can actually lead them to transfer their respect for Torah to the counselor. That can happen. Of course, it can also go down the tubes, right? There's also the possibility that they hated their rabbis in school. They, you know, thanks a lot. That wasn't helpful at all. There's also healthy countertransference that can come up. I see two hands. Hang in there. There's also healthy countertransference coming the other way, meaning that if learning Torah with a patient will actually help the counselor to build an effective relationship with the patient. So these are all benefits. We're about to get to the detriments, and those are the downside. I'm going to go through them actually first and then go back to the two hands that I see up. Number one, there are potential unhealthy transference and countertransference possibilities. The patient, as I said, may have hostility or other negative feelings towards the Torah authority that now get transferred to the therapist. The patient may come to see the therapist as a religious figure and not a medical figure. Like there's somebody who comes to teach them Torah, they're not their psychologist. If the therapist comes to see the therapy in a religious light, that may change the way they treat the patient and not necessarily in a positive way. It's a countertransference issue as well. Your chavrusa or your student is not your patient. So that's a tremendous risk to be considered. That's one issue. Another issue, very, very important, not to end up abusing Torah in order to make it fit the psychological message, right? It's bad enough that rabbis do that. We don't need therapists doing it also. Your message is your message, and the Torah is the Torah, and you can't warp one to fit the other. I brought you from Rabbi Dr. Spiro in source number 21, where he says, a reading of some psychological interpretations of biblical events and personalities and of the meaning of mitzvot leaves one with the nagging sensation that modern conceptions have been forced onto fortuitously similar ancient literature. That's exactly what I was trying to say, but he's just using better syllables. But that's a concern. And then one more concern is what Dr. Frankel is quoted here by Rabbi Bolka Alav Hashalom in source number 22. Rabbi Bolka, of course, having been an expert and wrote a lot on logotherapy. And actually, when I spoke about logotherapy years ago, Rabbi Bolka volunteered a lot of help, and it was incredibly helpful for me. So Rabbi Bolka says the following, quoting Dr. Viktor Frankl in source number 22. He says, as for logotherapy, as a secular theory and medical practice, it must restrict itself to such a factual statement, leaving to the patient the decision as to how to understand his own being responsible, whether along the lines of religious beliefs or agnostic convictions. Logotherapy must remain available for everyone. To this I would be obliged to adhere, if for no other reason, by my Hippocratic oath. He says, you can't start imposing religion on people. You have to be really, really careful ethically about that. Whether that's really an issue of the Hippocratic oath or not, I understand, is not so clear-cut. But from an ethical perspective, therapy is not outreach. It's not appropriate to try to turn it into that. Okay, you waited really a long time. Thank you. Moish.
I'd like to go somewhere that is a bit beyond what you're talking about, but I think it's part of the same thing, which is that I think a lot of the difficulty that happens here, and that is really not talked about, in part Dr. Abbo spoke about it, is that Judaism is a very normative, I'll use the word religion or culture, whatever you want to use. That in itself is the problem for a lot of people who need this sort of help, and you can include me in one of them. just the idea that I have to go to Dublin 3 times. But whether I do go or not, but the idea that the culture requires that, that I eat at certain times, that I say Shema at certain times, and I could go on forever, and forget about the yeshiva kid who's totally lost, because he has to learn and eat and everything, and a lot of that can become the problem, and it can start out just as an incident problem, but then the entire norm, the entire concept of norms, just...
So I'm coming back to that. Right. So I'm coming back to that in vignette number 3, assuming I get there. So hang in there, because that's going to be an important point. 910266, tell me what you have to say. I can't see you. I just have a number. Yes.
Well, I did put my hand up, so hi, I'm Jack Lefkowitz's sister. I'm calling in from Passaic.
Hi, girl.
I'm a physician, but I just want to say 2 things. First of all, you know, part of working with someone is to say to them, what matters most to you? And for some of those patients, they say God, you know, and how God fits into the world, and, you know, how they understand whatever they're going through is part of, you know, perfecting themselves in this world, or whatever they say. And then part of our role, and it may not be religion, but in this case, yeah, I'd say it is, part of our role is to weave that into the solutions, you know? Like, if we want people to make behavioral changes or do better, we need to link that into what matters most to them. And if that's their Yiddishkeit and their relationship with God, then let's say even when I do mindfulness, for instance, I'll weave it into the mindfulness. And I think it really ends up being really helpful.
Mm-hmm. So I definitely hear you. You're adding to the benefits the fact that it actually can have a pivotal therapeutic role. But how do you determine whether it's appropriate for the particular patient in front of you?
Well, I think it's the patient's choice. Like, for instance, say there's a person that, like, I actually do, let's say I've trained in neuro-linguistic programming and Erickson hypnosis and mindfulness, and I have someone who's a Rebbetzin, who's very from, very connected to Hashem, and that's how she speaks, that's her language, that's part of our communication. Then I'm gonna reflect that back,
mm-hmm.
You know?
I definitely hear it.
Again, it also, whatever you do, you're always getting feedback. You're watching the patient, you're listening to the patient, you're looking at body language, facial expressions. If you're going a certain path and it's not working, you're getting feedback immediately. Hey, I better change my path.
Mm-hmm.
But for a lot of the patients, especially in the firm community, some of those patients that I work with love it. They embrace it, and you can see it, you know. And,
right.
And I think it's really a kind of ongoing communication and feedback that you're getting
right.
all the time.
So the impression I'm getting from what you're saying and what others have said is that it could be incredibly valuable and it could also be destructive.
Oh, exactly right. Like, on the other hand, if you're working with someone who's rejected Yiddishkeit and like going the other way, you end up being in a situation often where you're validating it there for them in a way that's meaningful for them, but really has nothing to do with your own values. It's really being in the other person's perspective and their values. Sometimes it can be challenging as a firm physician, but that is our role and our obligation as physicians,
mm-hmm.
to be there and understand the other person's world and their perspective. But
right.
there are opportunities where Yiddishkeit and bringing in God and religion into the solutions is really, really helpful.
I definitely hear. Someone messaged me in the chat with the suggestion of referring to the patient to the rabbi or to a book as a way to be able to do this, but sometimes they want the conversation with the therapist. I go back to what I said before, which
right.
is you have to be really clear with the patient about who you are. I'm functioning as a psychologist, I'm functioning as a psychiatrist, I'm functioning as a therapist. They can't blur that line, but at the same time, it can be useful in the conversation. What I take away from this is, again, the utility of it, the risk of it, the importance of speaking to the patient not as their rabbi, and having the patient choose the path of the therapy, and have the patient speak to whether it's helpful. I'm just gonna jump to vignette number 3, and I know there's more to be said on this, and I'm sorry for cutting that short, because I really want to get to number 3. Number 4, I knew I wasn't going to get to, but I put a very important piece about it at the end of the source sheet that I think is worth reading. But vignette number 3. Judith, a medical resident training to specialize in eating disorders, notices that the observant Jewish community has a higher rate of eating disorders than other communities. And I didn't make that up for this vignette. This has been much discussed, including in Toronto. Judith asks Samantha, an observant Jewish colleague, if she can explain this. What should Samantha make sure to tell Judith? So because we only have 10 minutes to go, I'm actually going to speak first and then take comments if there's time. There are certain ways in which Judaism can intensify challenges with eating disorders, with other issues also, but certainly with eating disorders. Not that Judaism causes it, but there are elements of Judaism that can be a trigger for people who are already vulnerable due to biology, due to psychology. I'm going to refer you to a source which I put later on the sheet. I'm not sure why. I should have put it earlier. Take a look at source number 26. I love this source. Joseph Ciarochi, The Doubting Disease, Help for Scrupulosity and Religious Compulsions. Scrupulosity being a term for essentially what they call religious OCD. OCD that manifests in a religious context, like people who repeat Shema a lot because they're afraid they're not pronouncing it properly. He says, a superficial view may lead an observer to conclude, as do some mental health professionals, that religion is the source of scrupulosity. The reason why they have OCD is because of their Judaism. After all, a scrupulous man obsesses about sinning if he feels attracted to a pretty woman only because he believes it constitutes, quote, committing adultery in his heart. The superficial view fails to distinguish between religion causing the disorder from religion as its background. Religion does not cause scrupulosity any more than teaching someone French history causes him to believe he is Napoleon. All human beings exist in some cultural context. Cultural backgrounds provide the scenery around which emotional problems create the drama, or drama, Canadians. The point here is that there are elements of Judaism which can trigger things, but it's not coming from Judaism. Studies have shown that the rate of OCD is the same in cultures around the world, religious, not religious, Western society, Eastern society. Doesn't make a difference. The only question is where it's going to manifest itself. And in Judaism, there are triggers. We encourage limitations on pleasure. We encourage control of physicality, including eating. Take a look on your sheet at source number 23. Advice from the Rambam in a work of law, Mishneh Torah. One should not eat to the point that his stomach is full. He should lack about one quarter of his satiation. Always make sure that you eat only three quarters of it. The Rambam is saying this in a work of law that carries a lot of weight. I learned this as a kid, and it definitely makes an impact, teaching this kind of control. We have an emphasis in Judaism on physical beauty, and yes, there are sources for and there are sources against. There's Sheker HaChein VeHevel HaYofi, beauty is false. And then on the other end, you have a passage in the Talmud which talks about the beauty of our ancestress Sarah and the beauty of our ancestress Chava. I brought it in source number 25. So we have elements within Judaism holding up beauty as an ideal, teaching us to control what we eat and think of kashrut and some of the other things that Moish mentioned before about the norms of Judaism. And it absolutely can be challenging. It's not only eating disorders. It can be challenging for OCD. It can be challenging for anxiety disorders in general, right? I brought you other sources here, which we, I'm not reading aloud, but in source number 27, you get advice in Pirkei Avot about never clearing your heart for emptiness, which sounds like anti-relaxation, which I think the self-care advocates would be horrified by. It's true. There are things that can really trigger that. We talked about before, Judaism's recognition of thoughts as significant. That plays into obsessions for people. At the same time, there are elements of Judaism that can be a help, right? We talk about not having pleasure, but look at source number 28, a passage from the Jerusalem Talmud about making sure that you try every new fruit that comes out in order to credit God for it. Now that itself can become an obsession, fine. But the idea of making sure to enjoy that which God gave us to enjoy. Classic, source number 29 from Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch. This gets misquoted all the time. People say that Rabbi Hirsch said that when you get to the next world, God is going to want to know, did you see my Alps? So he never said that. But this is what he did write. I almost believe that all you homebodies would one day have to atone for your staying indoors. When you would desire entrance to see the marvels of heaven, they would ask you, did you see the marvels of God on earth? Then, ashamed, you would mumble, we missed that opportunity. He wants you to travel. He wants you to see and enjoy the world that God gave you. Maimonides writes in source number 30 about the importance of being healthy. You need to have a settled mind and a settled body. I didn't want to get into social media and the issues of gossip that go on and how Judaism can be helpful in teaching a person to avoid gossip. One therapist, one psychologist wrote to me about the importance of seeds, sleep, exercise, eat, diet, and stress. And you can bring sources in Judaism that are helpful regarding all of those. There's a lot that can be helpful. But I do think it's important to go back to our vignette. It's important for the therapist. It's important for patients to be aware of the risks that do come in with Judaism, going back to what Moshe said before. It's really important to be cognizant of it and know where the potential pitfalls are. I'm going to take questions and comments on this vignette rather than race to vignette number four. I don't think racing to number four is a good idea. Number four we'll have to hold over some other time, but you can read what I brought you in the source there. I think it's still helpful. But any questions and comments on number three or on the session in general? We have a few minutes remaining. No, we covered number three that well. Yes, Moshe.
Hi, I just want to make a brief comment. I don't want to suggest by previous comments that I thought that the normativeness and judgmentalism of Judaism brought about these problems. But they might very much exacerbate what starts elsewhere, mm-hmm. and they might make the treatment very, very much different than required.
Right, and they definitely hear. Before I take Dr. Libman's comment, just a reminder again for everybody, because when I first said it, there were like 50 people on, and then there were 90 people on. Please make sure that you sign in the chat if you want CME credit. Thank you very much. Yes, Dr. Libman. You are muted.
Thanks very much. I think there is something unique about Orthodox Judaism and the Shidduchim system and how you have to send a picture and you have to look good right away. And there is pressure on a woman to be thin. And I think that the entire society, not just from people, worship thinness, but there is something structural about the Shidduch system. Send the resume. Oh, she looks a little bit tzuchtig, not for my son. You know, so there is so much of that, and also many girls, when they go off to seminary, they gain a little bit of weight. They have all this freedom. And then they come back, and now they gotta get sins. And I think there is an appeal for eating disorders, but I'm not sure I'd like to share this so openly with a non-from either Jew or non-Jew, because it's a little bit embarrassing. Actually,
it is embarrassing,
but it's an important issue. What's happening in the from world?
Yeah, I agree that it's embarrassing, and I agree that it's important. You know, the truth is that the whole world, Jewish, non-Jewish, people are obsessed with appearances, and that ain't getting better. But the fact that it's put into a system which has such authority to it, it's a sanctioned system, part of a community, which has parents buying into it and rabbis buying into it, makes it worse. It's one thing when you live in a society in which it's known guys are shallow. It's another thing when you live in a society in which it's understood that there's going to be a shidduch resume and it has to include a photograph. It sanctions it in a way that I agree. I think is very unhealthy. When I was growing up, there was no such thing. Not that I'm such an old man yet. But I think it's extremely problematic. Okay, Dr. Habo, you had your hand up or you took it down?
Nope. Yeah. I guess I was just, again, related to the Shidduchim scene. I've heard a
not Jewish thing. Like, where is the focus on, you know, the person and the inside and the midos, et cetera, et cetera. And then there was just also just a point about, in terms of having Shabbos and larger meals, typically on Shabbos and so on and so forth, it's possible to see that somebody might sort of minimize their eating during the week because they have to make, you know, they're typically eating more on Shabbos, and that sort of pattern has, I've seen that as well in female patients.
Right. No, I definitely hear it. Thank you. And I just go back to what you had said before. I wouldn't call it a not Jewish thing, meaning there are, I mentioned, you know, one source with the Gemara. There are sources in Judaism that do recognize the impact of the visual on human beings and give it a certain status. As an example, a woman who's within 30 days after getting married, if she then, you know, Tisha B'Av hits or Yom Kippur hits or she's in mourning, is able to bathe in certain ways because of the understanding that her husband, if he sees her this way so soon after the marriage, it's going to affect the way that he looks at her. It's a recognition that the visual does affect people. So I hesitate to say that it's not a Jewish thing when there are elements within Judaism that feed into it. But I don't think we need to feed into it more. I don't think we need to elevate it and give it credibility by saying that a shidduch resume has to include a photo. I think that is a mistake. Okay, Dahlia, and then I'm going to call it here. Yes. You're muted.
I just want to say that the Torah certainly makes a big deal out of how beautiful Ori, my home was, how gorgeous Esther was, how gorgeous Bathsheba was, that she became the mother of King Shlomo.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of emphasis on beautiful women.
Yeah. With Esther, not necessarily. It depends on how you take it. In the Gemara, they have this whole discussion about Esther. Did she use olive skin complexion or whatever that was? But overall, you are correct.
That was just racial bias.
Okay. So, thank you very much, everyone, for participating. I really appreciate it. I'll send out follow-up email tonight or tomorrow, God willing. We're going to have to continue this at some point. So thank you again very much. Be well.
Thank you, Rabbi Yeshikola. Very special to